supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Its beans, or seeds, also do contain the notorious poison ricin. Is it a safe plant to have around? We'll examine the issues surrounding the castor bean plant when we get to the question of the week. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Glad to be here.
Well, glad to have you here. John, where are you?
I'm in Evanston, Illinois.
Oh, I know where that is. I used to go to a big power equipment and home show there every year.
Sounds fun. Well, my wife and I used to live outside Philly, and we would listen to your show every Saturday morning, but since it's not syndicated here, we listen on podcast instead.
Well, good for you, and you yell at your local public radio station to put me on the air.
Will do.
All right, what's your problem? What you got going?
So, in this house, my front and rear lawn are have been ambushed what I believe to be creeping bent grass, and starting to plan for spring. And my wife wants it eliminated, and I'm in agreement with her. And I'm looking for a chemical-free way to deal with it, other than potentially resodding the whole thing. And I've done some research, and it's funny. It seems creeping bent grass is actually prized by some people, where I'm kind of viewing it as more of a weed right now.
Do you know what kind of people?
As far as I can tell, people who run golf courses.
Yes. Yes. Creeping bent grass is the grass of choice for putting greens.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the only grass that can be mowed at an astronomically low height survive. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
1/10 of an inch.
Well, I don't know if I want to go that extreme.
And
but,
survive when it mixes in with a lawn of a normal height. I'm told you get these puffy, irregular patches that are clearly not your desired grass. And wouldn't it be lovely if simply cutting your grass at the right height would crowd out the creeping bent grass?
That was my first strategy, and that has not worked.
Well, it was a good strategy.
Okay.
It just turns out that, you know, if you can imagine a grass that can survive literally being killed every other day, must have some impossible inner strength. And in this case, it is the stolons, the part that crawl laterally.
Right.
Across the surface of the soil. They are impossibly strong, and they don't care how high you cut them, and they can survive a bigger cut. And unfortunately, our lawn care expert, Dr. Nick Christians from Iowa State University, says that when it does invade a lawn, there is no selective cure for it. And he says that because there are no selective controls for it, really the only answer is to rip up the lawn and start over. The only thing wrong with your plan is the timing. Spring is not the time to really reestablish, although you did use the word sod.
Mm-hmm.
Were you considering buying sod?
Yes.
Then you can do it in the spring.
Okay.
This is a warm season grass. It is going to be the strongest in the spring. As the weather warms up and this stuff greens up, it's going to resist you. So that doesn't mean anything bad, because you can get the best quality sod in the springtime. It just means I'm going to urge you to till up your existing soil while the soil is still fairly cold. And that'll make it much easier for you to rake out as many of the stolons as you can, because they'll be dormant. This is the time to attack them. what I would suggest you do is you have the lawn torn up, really torn up, rake it repeatedly, you know, have it screened as much as you can without being obsessive.
Mm-hmm.
Try to get most of the stolons, but then have a big load of topsoil or yard waste compost brought in.
Mm-hmm.
Before you spread that, level what you have.
Mm-hmm.
Don't
That's
worry.
That's the other problem with the yard. It's kind of uneven.
And you'll never get a good-looking cut unless you level.
Okay.
So you want to level it, and then you want to cover that material, that leveled material, with your new seed bed, with like an inch of good high-quality compost or topsoil, and then they'll rough up the bottom of the sod and lay that right down on top of your seed bed. And as long as you keep that sod really well watered, make sure it gets well established, cut it at the correct height, 3.5 inches if you get turf type tall fescue, 3 inches if you get bluegrass.
Uh-huh.
The bent grass should remain buried under there forever.
Okay, got it.
So I think you actually have a pretty good plan.
Thank you. I appreciate your help, because I guess my other option would just be to mow it and put the putting green back in place.
That's right.
Wonderful. I appreciate being on your show, and I thank you for your advice. And
All
I look
right.
forward to listening to you for now and for years to come.
Excellent. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, Mike. Be well.
1-888-346-9499. Catherine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Catherine. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. How are you?
I am doing well myself. And where is Catherine well?
I'm in Kempton, so that's northern Lehigh County, just below the Blue Mountain.
What can we do for Catherine in Kempton?
Okay, well, we live in a stone farmhouse,
mm-hmm.
and we have two large pear trees that were here. They're probably about 35 to 40 feet, but I think they may be the culprits behind our terror in our house, which are copious amounts of stink bugs. We are just living in terror. Anytime it gets warm out, they come out, and it's not just a few like my friends have. It's a lot of stink bugs, and because it's a stone house, I think they're getting in the cracks and the crevices in the house when it gets cold out, and that's kind of it.
Okay.
What I'm wondering, though, is are the pear trees to blame? Because I know they like to eat pit fruit. I would hate to cut the trees down, but if I have to live with these stink bugs anymore, I'm willing to see them go.
The trees are innocent. The trees are as much a victim as you are. You are near ground zero. This is an imported pest that showed up about 5 years ago called the marmorated stink bug. It comes from Korea, and it entered the country and was first discovered in the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania. In their native habitat, like multicolored Asian ladybugs and conifer seed bugs and some other insects, they have a natural inclination to try to hibernate inside cliffs, inside caves, and inside structures. So your home to them, when the weather starts to cool down, looks like a cave. And because it's a stone house with clicks and clacks and all that, all these nice little routes inside, it is a cave to them. Now, they're going to attack your pear trees, and you probably do want to do something to try to protect your harvest if you enjoy the pears. And one of the easiest things you can do is buy a product called Surround. It's a clay spray, and you spray the developing fruit on the pears, and it puts a clay film over top of the fruit that insects won't go near. They won't step on the clay, and it's a physical barrier against disease, too. If stink bugs are your only problem on the pear tree, I would urge you to get some Surround, get a good sprayer, mix it up, and spray the pear trees. It's clay. It's totally non-toxic. For your house, when the weather starts to cool down, there is a guy, I believe in Delaware, who made the most ingenious stink bug trap of all time. And I believe his website is called trapbug.com. If you go online and you just search the words stink bug trap, this is the dirt simplest thing to make. It's two pieces of cardboard, like a pizza box, with some spacers inside. You make sure it's light colored, and then all these creatures are coming into your home on the south side, on the sunny side of your house. So as we get towards the end of summer and these creatures look for places to hibernate, you hang these big panels that are hollow on the outside of the south-facing side of your house. At the end of the day, you will empty these over a trash can that's got some soapy water in the bottom. You
okay.
will empty hundreds, perhaps thousands of stink bugs a day. There's okay. a link to these traps up at our website at You Bet Your Garden. You can search it on the internet. These things work great. And then Rescue, which is a company that makes professional insect traps for farmers, they have a light trap that you can use inside your house in the winter to capture them. All you need to do is put this little light trap up, it's an LED light, in the room where you see them the most, close the doors, turn the other lights off. In the morning, all of the stink bugs that were hiding in that room will be trapped in the trap. So you can even knock them out of your house after they get in. But certainly the combination of hanging the trap on the outside and then having this light trap ready for any that do make it inside, you won't have this problem again next year. And,
okay.
for God's sake, don't cut down your trees. Just enjoy those pears. Just make sure you protect them from the stink bugs because you know how they deface the fruit.
Will do. Thanks so much.
All right. Good luck to you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn all of our listeners in and around the Akron area that I'm going to return to the land of Wicked Wind Chill to appear at the Akron Home and Flower Show on Saturday and Sunday, February 25th and 26th. But don't go marking your calendars or making plans to escape just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and whether or not it's safe to grow the infamous castor bean plant in your landscape. I'm infamous Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY and offers an interdisciplinary Master of Environmental Studies program for students who are passionate about clean air, clean water, and a clean earth. Academic work on local and global environmental issues is combined with fieldwork around Philadelphia and around the world. Details about pursuing your passion for the environment at Penn can be found online by searching Penn MES, Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies.
Your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting, supports WHYY. I'm Eric Frame, President. Details at yourparttimecontroller.com. Your part-time controller, building stronger nonprofits, one accounting department at a time.
The WHYY forecast, a wintry mix of snow, sleet, and rain is going to taper off, a high 33 today, partly cloudy with a low of 31 degrees tonight. Currently it is 30 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, how dangerous is the castor bean plant? Does it keep moles away from your garden? How big does it get? Does it deserve its reputation for being the deadliest plant out there? We'll examine all the qualities of this very unusual and striking specimen when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Susie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Susie. How are you?
I am fine.
And where is Susie fine?
I am in Edmond, Oklahoma.
We know where that is, our good friends in the Oklahoma City area. What can we do for Susie in Oklahoma?
I have a problem with a rose bush. I planted the rose bush about 8 or 10 years ago, and when it was very young, its first couple of years, it had a few large, soft pink blooms. And I don't think it's had any blooms in the last 5 or 6 years. And it grows huge every year, and it just keeps growing, and it looks healthy. It just never has any blooms.
Okay, and you said when you bought it, the blooms were pink.
Yes.
Okay. Does it get a lot of sun?
Yes.
Do you feed it?
Yes, I feed it.
What do you feed it?
Well, you're not going to like what I feed it.
It sounds like the rose doesn't like what you feed it, Susie. So
I think
we're going to be unanimous.
One rose. All of my other roses bloom, and they get the same food. This one gets what everybody else gets, and it's either 10-20-10 or 13-13-13 or 12-12-12. And sometimes it gets a little compost, but mostly the only compost it gets is what composts itself in the perennial bed that it's in.
Okay. Well, you know, these chemical fertilizers are very tough on your water supplies and your soil in Oklahoma. You have naturally alkaline soils already, and you really shouldn't be adding chemical salts to them. And those equal numbered ones you mentioned, you know, they fool people into thinking they're balanced. There's no plant on the planet that wants equally balanced numbers. So obviously, I would like to see you move to a more natural fertilizer. There's some great organic rose foods out there that would give you plants that may not grow as rapidly and as rampantly, but that would produce many more roses. But you say your other roses are doing fine, so there's something wrong with this one. And the location.
Yeah, because there's a rose 6 feet away from it who in the same bed, and it blooms just fine.
And again, you said it gets full sun, everything else is equal. Do you prune the roses?
Yes.
When do you prune them?
I prune them when you say to prune them, which is in the spring when they first start to leaf out.
Excellent. Good. I can only think of one thing that could be going on here, because you've also implied that this rose is growing faster and more aggressively than the others.
It seems to grow very well, but not necessarily better than the other roses.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. Do you remember that when you planted it, was it a grafted rose? Was it grafted onto another rootstock?
I don't. The only thing that I remember about it is that it was a hybrid tea.
I am going to suggest that what happened to you is a very common occurrence. I'm guessing that you bought a grafted rose, and when you planted it a little bit too deeply. Anytime you get a tree or a rose or any kind of woody plant that's been grafted, what they've done is they've taken a rootstock that has characteristics that they really want, and they've taken another plant in that genus and kind of tied it on to the top of it because they love those flowers. What happens, people see that area where the two plants have been joined together, and for some reason the natural human instinct is to bury that graft for safety. And that's the opposite of what you should do. All grafts should be above ground in the open air. Because what can happen, especially if the top of the plant gets any kind of stress or shock or, you know, just doesn't thrive, because the graft is underground, the bottom rows can take over. And unfortunately, with roses, about half the rootstocks out there are what are called multiflora rose, which is a wild rose that was used as natural fencing. Most multiflora roses bloom, but the blooms are fairly insignificant. They're very small. They're very white. Is that what you have?
No. I mean, I have some other roses that are multiflora, and yes, they have small blooms, and they grow like mad, and they're not beautiful roses. And now that you're saying that, what's happened is this one small section of the rose bloomed. And I think that's exactly what I did. I either buried it too deeply or that section died off.
Right, and sometimes you can bury it at the right height, but then mulch gets mounded around it. And as soon as you cover that graft, that allows the rootstock to get mischievous and replace the plant you wanted with one you didn't.
Okay.
So
that makes all the sense.
In the future, make sure the top of the plant, any plant you buy, looks good and healthy, and make sure that that graft point stays well above the soil line.
And I should take this one out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, got it.
All right.
You really helped.
Good luck, Susie.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Mark, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yeah, hi, how you doing?
I'm okay, Mark. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm trying to break the cycle of the weed infestation in my garden.
And where is your garden, Mark?
It's in Margate, New Jersey.
Down the shore.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, it's an organic garden. You know, I use all organic stuff, but every year the weeds are so voracious. I've been using the black fabric plastic, the black fabric to, you know, keep them down.
Oh, the so-called weed barrier?
Yeah, right.
Don't you understand that a weed barrier is actually a foreign plot to make sure that we grow lots of weeds? And that their roots are well protected?
Yeah, they certainly are.
When you put that fabric down, you have to note that even though most of the surface area is solid, there's lots of little holes in it for air and water to get through. If you were to try to design a situation where you wanted to have a lawn or grassy plants that nobody could pull out, you would grow them through this weed fabric. If you think about it, those little holes are perfect for grassy weeds, and the rhizomes that give birth to the grass, well, they're all protected now underneath that weed barrier. They're totally safe down there. And of course, grassy weeds are the worst weeds there are. Now, what kind of an area are we talking about? Since you're using weed fabric, we know the weeds are not in a lawn. Is this a vegetable garden, a flower garden?
It's a vegetable garden. It's about 10 or 12 by 20 to 25.
So it's a flat ground garden.
That's right.
And it's grassy weeds.
Well, you know, I don't know what kind of weeds they are, but, you know.
You say it's a vegetable garden, right?
That's right.
Take that area of yours and map it out so where you're going to have some nice 4x8 raised beds with 2 feet of walking lanes in between them. You know, map it out with stakes and string. And then pull, you know, your hardest job is going to be getting this weed fabric up, man, because this stuff is really tenacious.
I got it up. I tore it up this season already, end of the season, and I already planted my garlic. But, again, like I said, I'm just worried about next year.
Okay. Well, outside of the area where the garlic is growing, I want you to grow some raised beds. Before you do anything, I want you to level the surface of the soil real well, and then I want you to lay down a single piece of heavy cardboard across the entire area. And then in the area where you're going to grow your crops, you install your frames, no wider than 4 feet, but they can be as long as you make them. A lot of people like 4x8 because it's standard lengths of lumber.
Right.
Fill your frames with a combination of rich, screened black top soil and compost. I want you to have a nice quantity of shredded leaves available. After you get your plants installed, cover the bare ground between the plants with shredded leaves, you will never see a weed again.
It's, so are you talking about like oak leaves?
Sure, as long as they're shredded.
Yeah, we don't have any leaves in Margate, but I'd have to go offshore and pick those up.
Yeah, but you can go into Philly, you can go into the suburbs, and you can all you got to do is go around. You can go trash picking in the fall when people put out the stupid people bags where it's you can even tell it's leaves inside.
Okay.
But there is no way to successfully control weeds either with weed fabric or when you're trying to grow in flat ground. And once you experience how much easier it is to care for a raised bed vegetable garden, how much better it looks, how much more produce you get from a small area. You'll wonder why you wasted so much time. Go on to our website. Go to You Bet Your Garden. Go to the Garden Answers A to Z. Go to R for Raised Beds and read up on it and even just build a few.
Okay.
Because the weeds you're battling, they can't climb. If you're growing a foot above the surrounding area, there's no way the weeds can get up to you. Raised bed gardening saves a tremendous amount of time and energy.
Okay, great. I appreciate it.
All right, good luck, Mark.
Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Monroe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you, sir?
I'm pretty good.
And where is Monroe good?
In Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Ah, very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, we just moved into a new house, which has some beautiful maple trees lining the street. I noticed that in the end of September, most of them lost their leaves. Now, every other tree on the block kept their leaves through Halloween. And I'm just wondering if that's a sign of malnutrition, or if they're sick, or if I can do something either over the winter or in the spring that might improve the longevity of the leaf-keeping season.
Now, Monroe, where'd you move from?
From Bethlehem to Bethlehem.
Okay, so you moved in, you know, because you did notice we had the most wretched growing season in history, right?
Yes.
We had that horrible, long, hot drought instead of a spring, and then it just rained endlessly. Now, are you really sure that your maples all dropped their leaves and all the other maples in the neighborhood still had theirs, or are you looking at different deciduous trees?
Well, I'm pretty sure that I saw maple trees with their leaves at least through the middle of October.
Mm-hmm.
And on my trees, I actually noticed some new growth in October as well, which was interesting. One or two branches had very green leaves, but the rest were gone.
Up in the canopy, though, not close to the ground or anything
right.
like that. Good, 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 good. Now, you say these trees are under your control, so that they're on your property.
Yeah, they're my responsibility.
Are they landscaped? Are they mulched? They don't have this decorative mulch around their base, do they?
No, they're all on the apron, and the apron is just whatever grass is there. Most of it is moss, though, actually, to be honest.
Now, walk me through this. Are they in between of pavement and the street?
Yes, the sidewalk, then the apron, then the street.
Oh, man. One of the issues here is this kind of tree planting was probably really ill-advised. These little strips of greenery are very reassuring. I mean, they're nice to have there. They kind of block the traffic. But can you imagine being a tree stuck in this little this little island of really poor dirt and you're under assault by every dog, cat, and squirrel that walks by?
Absolutely.
One of the issues here is the street and the concrete really heat up, and they get much hotter in the root zone than trees that are kind of growing in a natural setting, surrounded by large amounts of earth and other greenery. So these street trees are always going to show stress. More than trees that are just specimen trees in front of a house or in a front yard. I do not think that other than the way they're planted, there's anything wrong with your trees. We saw and we heard an awful lot of early leaf drop. I had a lot of leaves coming down. Even in August, the plants were just sick of it. I mean, they just wanted to be done with the season. They had really been drought-stressed early on, and then they were being drowned. And in many ways, dropping their leaves is a protective response. It allows the trees to really shut the door on the season and kind of go into an early dormancy. And then we also heard a lot of reports of trees dropping their leaves even much earlier than you report yours, and then trying to grow a second set of leaves. I would say you'd be perfectly fine here doing nothing, because I presume these are big, well-established trees that have fought their way through a lot of bad years. If you want to do, there's two things you can do. One, you might want to do a simple soil test just to see how acidic that soil is. And if it's really a very low pH, you could sprinkle a little bit of lime or wood ash around the trees to bring the soil up to a little closer to neutral, or, you know, 6.5 to 7. That would help them relax a lot. And if you want to give them a feeding, just put down like an inch of compost in between them in this area. Don't do anything like tree spikes or anything like that. No chemical fertilizers. But probably, if anything, maybe their soil needs to be adjusted a little bit.
Great.
All right, man?
Okay. Thank you very much.
And let's all hope for a nicer season next year.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who doesn't have land of their own, but who still wants to eat fresh, local, and organic, that now is the time to seek out a spot in a nearby community garden. Community gardens give the landless a place to grow, and your plots will be right next to neighbors who are always willing to lend a helpful hand. And tools and seeds. But don't go looking through the list of community gardening organizations at our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and the straight story on the notorious castor bean plant. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The always enjoyable Jerry Fritz will present a free talk on cutting-edge perennials with free Band-Aids provided tomorrow, Sunday the 22nd at 2 p.m. at the Scott Arboretum of Swarthmore College. The Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture will hold their 21st annual Farming for the Future Conference, February 1st to the 4th, at the Penn Stater Conference Center in State College, PA. And I'll open my speaking season with an appearance at noon and 2 p.m. at the Grounds for Sculpture Park in Hamilton, New Jersey, on Sunday, February 5th. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
Checking the WHYY forecast, a wintry mix of snow, sleet, and rain tapering off this morning, a high 33 degrees tonight, partly cloudy, a low of 31, mostly cloudy for your Sunday, a high 38, Monday rain with temperatures warming up to 54. Currently 28 degrees in Philadelphia, 31 in Berlin, 29 in Wilmington at WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to the question of the week. A close examination of the castor bean plant with its poisonous fruits and dramatic tropical stature. What's the story? Should you grow these things in your garden? Are they safe to have around? We'll attempt to answer all those questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Amanda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Amanda. How are you?
I'm very well.
And
how are you?
I am doing just fine, thank you. Where is Amanda very well?
Duluth, Minnesota.
Ah, very good. What can we do for Amanda up in the frozen north?
I have a tropical ginger plant in a pot in front of a very large southeast-facing window.
Mm-hmm.
I've had it for several years. I got it because I have a daughter named Ginger. I also have a daughter named Daisy, and she has her flowers everywhere.
Uh-huh.
But Ginger does not get to see her flowers. So I bought one, even though I live in Minnesota, and I kept it in a pot. It's doing well, except for one thing. It has very crispy leaf tips, and the rest of the plant is fine. No matter what I do, it seems that like the watering or the compost or anything doesn't seem to fix it. It's just crispy at the tip. So I'm very confused.
Well, I wouldn't be. How long have you had this plant?
3 or 4 years.
And did you grow it from a piece of ginger that you bought in a grocery store or something?
No, I mail ordered it. It's from the Hedychium family. I think that's the best way to pronounce it.
Oh, so it's not a true ginger.
No, it's not a ginger that you eat. It's a tropical ginger grown for its fantastically intoxicating flowers.
Oh, okay. And what did you think the scientific name was now?
Hedychium, H-E-D-Y-C-H-I-U-M.
You bought this mail order, and I presume, do you take it out in that short period of bright light you call summer up there in Minnesota?
No, because it's such a big, heavy pot, and it's upstairs, and it's such a large window. It's about 5 feet by 9 feet that it seems to do fine, other than the leaf tips.
Okay, so it's in a big pot.
Yes.
What did you fill the pot with originally?
Probably just some sort of potting soil mix. I can't imagine I didn't put any like dirt from the garden in it.
That's good. What do you feed it with though?
Compost.
You do feed it with compost. Okay, so you do know it craves organic matter.
Yeah, I do it like once a year with an inch or two.
Oh, I think you could go more.
Oh.
Now, is this plant flowering for you over the winter, or does it go dormant in your winter?
That I'm still a little confused about. When I've had it in one of the windows up in the same room, it doesn't seem to flower, but if I put it in the other window that gets the afternoon light, it does flower there.
One thing we get into trouble with these kind of tropical plants, the advice that I'm looking at and the advice you've been given is to keep the soil moist. How moist do you keep it? How often do you water it?
You know, when I do only a quart, it doesn't even run through to the bottom. If I do 2 quarts, it runs through to the bottom.
Okay, so you really are keeping it moist, but it's not sopping wet.
No, yeah, even every time I water it, it's really dry. It just sucks it up. It's amazing.
Well, and is your house really dry?
Could be. Not in the summer, but in the winter, yeah.
I'm going to guess that this burnt tip phenomenon is much worse in the winter.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
I think the answer might be something as simple as a daily misting.
Interesting.
I think your house is really dry. I think if I were in your house right now and I got mad at you, I could put on a wool sweater, rub my feet on the floor, and go and touch you and probably send you shocked through a wall. So get a nice, fine mister. And you mist this plant down with lots of water on its leaves. First thing in the morning, I think you're going to see those margins, those leaf tips become much less brown over a short period of time. As we get to the spring, give it more compost. Give it an inch of compost in the spring, and then give it another inch of compost like 6 weeks after that. Mist it every morning, and I bet you this plant is going to perk up beautifully.
I am excited to try it.
Okay. Well, I can guarantee nothing bad will happen, and I have a good idea lots of good things will happen.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Amanda.
Thank you.
And try growing some of the other ginger, too.
I sure will.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Alan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for picking up the call. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
Audubon, Pennsylvania, near Valley Forge Park.
Oh, okay. A beautiful natural area out there. What can we do for Alan out near Valley Forge? I should say Audubon, because when I say Audubon, I see all birds flying around, you know.
I've got a pond, and we've been inundated with reeds and cattails. Tried a bunch of stuff to get rid of them. Nothing's working, and they're just taking over the pond. What do you suggest? Anything?
Well, what did you want there instead, Alan?
I want to get rid of them because they're invading the whole area. I can't control them. like almost like a bamboo. They send out these rhizomes and just keep progressing across the pond.
Yeah, but you know, they do provide food and cover for wildlife.
Yeah.
Nature abhors a vacuum, man. You can't get rid of something without having a replacement plan.
Actually, we want to put some fish in it. We've had water lilies in it, and they've done quite well.
Oh, they're very invasive if they get out of
your
pond.
Yeah, but I know, but they kept pretty much to where we had placed and
okay,
of all things, pretty good-sized pond. The deer come down, and we have blue heron and that type of thing coming in. And
the blue heron will eat your fish.
Yeah, the funny thing is, when we started out, we put some koi in and discovered that the blue herons spotted them and thought they were tasty.
Oh, yeah, they are.
And Well, my wife and I decided that we liked the sight of these giant blue herons coming down into the pond and liked them better than the koi, so we got goldfish and threw them instead, basically, to see the herons.
I don't have any real good news for you. You know, these reeds, these cattails, they are very successful plants. As you know, they do become very well adapted to these aquatic environments. It's a very natural place for them to be. They have everything that they need. So I think what you need is to dedicate some time and literally dig them out. You might need to get a little baby backhoe in there at the edge of the pond and try to get them under control. But one of the interesting benefits for you is once you get these things out, it would be great if you could shred them up and compost them. The compost that's made from plants that grew in water is tremendously good for plants that grow on land. The other option I would suggest to you is once you get a large area under control, see if there's a way you can install some rhizome barrier and keep a small area of the cattails, but prevent them from expanding outward, the same barrier that is sold to control bamboo from spreading.
That would be good. If I could hold them back, that would be very helpful.
Because I can't even imagine this pond without a few of them.
Yeah, when they first came in, we thought they were fairly attractive, but they literally have taken over a good portion of the pond, and it's impossible to get rid of.
Well, it is going to take you dedicated time this coming summer to get the bulk of them out of there, get them under control, and then install the rhizome barrier, and they can become just like one little corner of the pond as opposed to being a constant threat. You can enjoy them and control them at the same time.
That sounds like a winner. If I can get that done, I'd be happy with it.
They're very valuable plants, and more landscapers are getting very adept at installing this rhizome barrier. And if you can afford it, I would urge you to get some professional help to do that.
All right.
All right. Good luck,
Al. Thank you for your advice. I appreciate it. Take care now.
Well, thank you. Take care. All right. As promised, should you grow the castor bean plant? Our very thoughtful question this week comes from Gail in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. She writes, I have a question about a plant that I find very intriguing, the castor bean plant. I had seen a few in my neighborhood, and I finally tracked a plant down in nearby Ottsville, PA, thinking that I'd hit the jackpot. I planted it in a spot I thought it would like, judging from the others I'd seen, and it did thrive right outside my back door. Then I read an article about the plant in my favorite local paper, the Bucks County Herald, and was horrified. The described toxicity of the beans, though they're beautiful to look at, really scared me. I had known nothing about the beans being poisonous. I just loved the way it looked and how it added contrast to my garden. And I had just passed on some seeds to my mom. And as soon as I finished the article, I called her to say, don't touch them until I talk to Mike McGrath. I even had anxiety dreams about it, as we have four children, a beloved dog, and this plant is right outside our back door. The children are ages 6 to 12, so they know better than to ingest a bean, and the dog doesn't go into the garden that often. Am I overreacting to think that I should rip this specimen out of the ground and have my mom toss the seeds? Seeing the word ricin in the article literally scared me silly. My mom and I would love to hear your thoughts on this and always appreciate your words of wisdom and humor. Well, thank you, Gail. And yes, the dreaded, deadly castor bean plant. Let's begin with what it is. A dramatic tropical plant that can easily grow 10 feet tall in a season, with huge, colorful leaves as big as dinner plates. Now, because it is a tropical, Gail doesn't have to worry about the one she planted. It died from frost shortly after she wrote us back in October. But in frost-free climes, they can become small trees. Now, this plant has a surprisingly long history. With Lawrence Griffith's fine book, Flowers and Herbs of Early America, published by the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, citing references to it as far back as the 3rd century B.C. Early Egyptians apparently used oil pressed from the notorious seeds in their lamps, and Thomas Jefferson is known to have deliberately planted it in areas where he hoped it would live up to its folklore and deter moles. And, true to his famously competitive nature, he carefully nurtured one of those specimens to a height of 22 feet. Unfortunately, Jefferson probably learned that making George Washington extremely jealous was pretty much all the plant was going to do, as it seems to be universally acknowledged that a castor bean plant growing in soil does not deter moles. But some studies suggest that a specific form of castor oil distilled from the beans does repel moles, voles, and other underground pests when it's applied to the soil. As with medicinal castor oil, the poisonous ricin is removed during the distillation process. And yes, it really is ricin in the beans, the same deadly poison used in a famous political assassination involving a trick umbrella, and in numerous terrorist incidents, including a particularly nasty one in the Japanese subway system some years back. So, has Gail endangered her mother by sending her those seeds of death, which look, by the way, like engorged dog ticks? No! I found the seeds listed for sale in several 2012 catalogs, all with the warning to keep the seeds away from children, but otherwise touted as dramatic tropical ornamentals, especially some of the subspecies, which sport wildly colored leaves. The seeds are even safe to handle, as they have a heavy protective coating that must be broken to release any of the nasty bits inside. Some sources even say you could swallow the seeds without ill effect, as they would simply pass through you, and that you'd have to chew them to be poisoned. We do not suggest putting this advice to the test. Dr. Gerald Klingemann, a retired horticulturalist for the University of Arkansas Extension in Little Rock, once named the castor bean his plant of the week and called it a great choice for garden mavericks who like big, bold statements. He noted that while the toxicity of the beans was well established, he could find no evidence of reports of any accidental poisonings, only use of the active ingredient in murder plots. An official Canadian government site on poisonous plants notes that there have been cases of livestock poisoning, in addition to the well-known implication of the bean's ricin in terrorist and murder plots, and offers what well may be the best piece of advice for those who want to grow this striking specimen without worry. Don't let the plant set seed. Pull off all the flowers as they form, pull off immature seeds as they form, and just enjoy the massive leaves. Finally, the American Association of Poison Control Centers reports that poison information centers around the nation received 110 calls about, quote, exposure to castor beans in 2010, but that there were no major effects reported as a result of those exposures. Now, as we've always stressed on the show, teach children not to eat strange things, and don't grow plants with poisonous parts if you have small children or dogs that seem to chew on everything. Otherwise, go ahead and plant the seeds directly in the ground after all risk of frost is gone, in rich, well-drained soil, and see if you can beat Jefferson's 22-footer. Well, that sure was some interesting information about the famed castor bean plant, now wasn't it? Luckily for yous, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to feed me the beans if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin Griffin. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Non-toxic Alexis Landis produces and co-edits You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Amanda, no relation, McGrath, insists she has never been involved with any assassination plots involving castor beans. Our editor, Al Banks, is staring intently at the three-bean salad he had for lunch. Potentially deadly but misunderstood Mike McGrath saying, "It's okay as long as you didn't chew your food, Al." Oh, and I'll see you next week. Maybe not Al, but I'll see you next week. Although the butt of many jokes, Brussels sprouts are a highly nutritious member of the cabbage family. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the special tricks it takes to produce sprouts with a surprisingly sweet taste. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
You Bet Your Garden next Saturday at 11 here on WHYY.
Rutgers Camden supports WHYY and continues its Visiting Writers Lecture Series, 7 p.m. Wednesday, January 25th, featuring a reading by 2011 Pulitzer Prize winner Jennifer Egan, author of the book A Visit from the Goon Squad, which is slated to become an HBO series. Open to the public, the Rutgers Visiting Writers Series will be held in the Campus Center on the Rutgers Camden campus. Sponsored by the Rutgers Camden Master of Fine Arts Program in Creative Writing. For details, camden.rutgers.edu.